Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate being able to talk here, and also, you know, thank you very much for the organizers. I want to speak about remunization and rigidity and applications. And so I first want to sort of make the connection a little bit between remunization and rigidity. So the kind of remunization paradigm is that if you have topological conjugacy, then the conjugacy is better. And in the case of complex dynamics, it's often quasi-conformal, that is the natural context. But of course, in many cases, you know, you can do even better. And the first instance of this was the results by announced by Feigenbaum and sort of developed by a lot of people, but Sullivan got this description quite clearly, where he stated if you have two F and G Feigenbaum maps, so they're conjugate, then in fact the QC conjugate. And that's the kind of the starting point for minimization theory. And then, so the step after that was to sort of develop this picture and to even look at quasi-conformal. Sorry, I use secret language, quasi-conformal. Sorry? Well, QC, in fact, I need to be a little bit precise here. What I mean by this is that there's a quasi-conformal map from the complex plane to itself, which maps the post-critical set of one to the other one as a conjugacy. And I forget about the things outside. There are other statements, but I want to be vague for this moment. And then, so the next step was done by Lubitsch, and independently by Gracik and Swantik. And they looked at maps which are not actually renormalizable. And if you look at the sort of first return maps, instead of the first return maps in the one-dimensional case, in the real case, they would look like, you know, you have these small boxes and some iterate maps, this thing inside itself. The situation would be slightly more different. And if you take the complex version of it, it would be the following. You have some domain, or rather a range, and if you look at the first return map to this, there would be several domains. Some of them mapping univalidly, as a sort of one-to-one maps onto the range, and some of them as branch covering maps, 2-to-1 maybe, to this. And so this was the kind of setting that they considered. And so these were actually already introduced by Hubbard and Branner, and these are called quadratic-like. But perhaps they should be called generalized quadratic-like. And a special case of this is this Fibonacci map. And so if you have this situation, you can sort of make a kind of you can sort of do kind of remunization, because you have here perhaps this situation maybe with several branches, so you have some kind of what Lubitsch calls the principal nest, and so you have some range, and then you have these domains, the first return domains, and then you sort of consider the domain that is containing the critical points, and consider that as your sort of new situation, so you could sort of blow it up to full size again. So I've you know, blown this up to full size, and then look at the first return map to that one. In general, of course, infinitely many domains, but only you're only interested in the domains that contain points of the post-critical set. and so the number could vary. And so in this way you get sort of a whole nest of things which is called the principal nest. And so this is the kind of setting there. And then there was this rather remarkable result, which was published in the late 90s, to show that if you take two quadratic maps, two generalized quadratic-like maps, so F and G, two generalized quadratic maps F and G, and assume they're conjugate, then in fact the QC conjugate. So you have a quadratic-like map F here, another one G, and there's some conjugacy between them. And I want to be a little bit vague at this moment. What that means. Yes, so I want to, so that's why I kept here. So two generalized, and then, and this assumption was needed to make the assumption that it's real, and also that it's quadratic-like. And let me explain. The first point about real was because, in fact, you need to have some sort of this picture to start with. And so to get this picture, you need sort of real bounds, and with some work this could create complex bounds. Or in other words, by which I mean the following, that if you do this realization again and again, if you have this situation, you can sort of in principle repeat this procedure, unless the map is renormalizable, and then it may sort of stop for topological reasons. But suppose it's not renormalizable, then in fact you need some kind of information to control the situation, which is called complex bounds, and this is related to the idea that these domains are so well inside that. So for example, that if you take the difference of the range and one of the domains, that the moduli is bounded from below. So this is moduli bounds. So let me actually write that here. So if you take these domains, Pj, and then you have here a whole range of domains, 0, j, 2, 1, j, and so on, that this is your first return map. And then you need something like that these moduli are bounded from below. And real bounds come into this, at least in original proofs. So this was one of the ingredients, and the second ingredient was used at that point. And for that, it's actually kind of important that the map is not just anything, but that on the central branch, it's actually 2-to-1. So the quadratic nature of the critical point was important and allowed that this not only stayed away from zero, but actually goes to infinity. While that's not always true, there's certain situations you have to skip because of subtle cascades. But anyway, this is the kind of the setting. So if you skip at the end of a subtle cascade, you always get some growth. Skip subtle cascades. Okay, so this is the setting. Now, the problem is that if you want to generalize this to more general cases, for example, even to the situation, so this is the next step. Suppose you would even change it to something like this, z to the power 4 plus c. Then actually this step, that it goes to infinity, actually breaks down. And that really sort of makes this proof break down, unfortunately. But anyway, this was a very, very important step. And so the next step is, but actually, even in this case, for example, if you look at the Fibonacci case, you do have complex bounds, and in other cases it was also known that you had complex bounds. And in fact, you already had some kind of geometric information about puzzle pieces. For example, what was known is that the puzzle pieces for Fibonacci case, but also in other cases, something similar was sort of known, that it's not always going to be the case that these puzzle pieces are nice. They can sort of really squeeze down to something like that. But some kind of geometric bounds were sort of known, and that's what I will discuss now. So some information was known, and that led to the next step. So then, a very important ingredient I thought was given by Daniel Smania, and he gave a very nice interpretation, and I want to sort of give our version of the interpretation, which says the following. And this is related to the work of Heinonen and Koskela, and our version of it is the following. Suppose there exists a sequence of puzzle pieces. So by puzzle pieces, I just mean pullbacks of this in this chain. So you start with this range, and these are first return domains. So they're actually pullbacks of this one, and so on. So these are all pullbacks of the big piece, and they're called puzzle pieces. So if there's a sequence of puzzle pieces which has bounded geometry, so by which there exists a K, so that for these puzzle pieces exist in a point inside, so let me call this a puzzle piece, and a ball, and another ball, so that the radii of the ball, let's call this puzzle piece U for the moment, the puzzle pieces sit inside two balls of comparable radii. So they're bounded from below and from above by balls of comparable radii. So that's what is called bounded geometry, and then complex bounds. So what he showed is, if suppose, then if you take F and G in a setting like this, topologically conjugate, then in fact they're QC conjugate. So what it allowed for is to show that the homeomorphism that conjugates is actually can be assumed to be more smooth than you would otherwise have. And as I said, this assumption is certainly not satisfied always. You certainly will have puzzle pieces, somewhere in chains that may sort of be almost like a small interval. And so this bounded geometry condition is certainly not satisfied. But it's certainly true that if this holds, then the conclusion of quasi conformal rigidity holds. So then what Shen Kozlowski and myself did was to look at the polynomial. We considered slightly more general cases, polynomial-like box mapping, and the reason we use the word box mapping is because there are actually several critical points in the situation we will consider, and that will mean that you will not have precisely this picture, but I won't really emphasize that part in this talk. And suppose you have then the claim was, if you take it real, there exists a special, we call it an enhanced nest, with the assumptions from the left, it's always bounded geometry and complex bounds. And from this we could actually prove that, the conclusion there is clear, and the claim then would be that if f and g are real polynomials with real critical points, and when I say the topological conjugate, what I mean by this is that the conjugacy is assumed to map corresponding critical points of corresponding orders to corresponding orders. So I'm not assuming that the critical points are quadratic, but if it's the first critical point is of order 4, then the image of it is also of order 4. So if the topological conjugate, then the QC conjugate. And so the main point in this paper is to first to introduce this enhanced nest and to show that this bounded geometry. And in fact, this bounded geometry consists of two parts, lower bounds showing that you have sort of these balls that are fitting inside and that they fit inside, and for example, because we for the moment have done real things, so they fit inside. So you have a ball whose radius is comparable in size to the real trace. So that's the first part. And actually the proof of that is a little bit reminiscent of what already was done in the Fibonacci case, years before, where you go to big scale, you go sort of really, even though the map from some puzzle piece deep down is a pullback from here to there, so you have some map from here to here. That map, of course, has extremely high degree. So you would not expect to get any information from that. However, there are some parts where the map is actually quite well behaved. And from that you can get actually these lower bounds. The upper bounds was actually quite hard. And what I want to discuss is some simplification that we could make. And so what I want to next discuss is a next kind of ingredient, and this is due to Jeremy Kahn and Michel Lubich, and I think this is an absolutely wonderful result, and I'm going to state a version of it which is ours, which is for the real case, just because it's slightly easier to state and it's a slightly stronger conclusion and the proof is very short, but the result is really due to Jeremy Kahn and Michel Lubich, and I think it's an incredibly powerful result. So so this is our version of it, but so the statement is for all k, there exists a kappa. There's the following properties. So suppose you have some U, a domain that maps to V, and I'm going to assume in this special version that in fact the domains are real symmetric with respect to the evolution, and here also, and in fact that F is a composition of univalent or unicritical maps which are actually real. So that's an assumption we make just to understand this theorem. And then the statement is the following. So take some set B and take one of the pullbacks of B, and let's let that be here, and assume that they are actually symmetric with respect to the real axis, So they are, you know, symmetric with respect to the real axis. So A is one of the components of F inverse of B. It's a connected component of this set. Then the statement is the following. Oh, maybe I should first call D the degree of F and D, small d, the degree of F restricted to A. Then the statement is the following.
F is proper?
Yes, yeah. That the modulus of U minus A is bigger than K to the power D. Oh, little d?
No, F.
Oh, sorry, it's not little f. It's meant to be big F, thanks. So the minimum of some kappa, the kappa that I had to there, a modulus V minus B. So the statement is that if you want to have a lower bound for the modulus of U minus A, well, if you were just going to use the standard inequalities, you would expect to lose a factor 1 over d. So that would really not be good enough, and I'll also try to explain why this is a kind of... For all k and for it exists a kappa, maybe I should write a kappa more... The kappa is meant to be a Greek one, and this is supposed to be a Roman. So that for any F that you care to choose, this holds, and any A in. So this inequality says that you have a lower bound in terms of lower bound here, but of course if this is very big, if B minus B is very big, this doesn't say very much because you get a big loss here. This is a sort of fine operation that we have. But if you have that this is very small, then actually this can be very convenient. I'll show in a second why this is quite useful. And the picture you have to have, should keep in mind that for our applications, this is what we have in mind, is the typical situation. And this proof is actually just a page or something. This theorem. So, using this result, if you use the proper result by Kahn and Lubitsch, you can actually also treat non-real polynomials, and there's a paper by Avila, Kahn, Lubitsch, and Shen dealing with this case, maps of this type which are non-renormalizable, and stating that if you take two such maps and they're conjugate, the quasic formula conjugate, you have complex bounds, and the whole story still holds. And in fact, using precisely, if you use our methods and the enhancedness that I will discuss in a minute, then in fact this will also hold for not just the unit critical, but also for the polynomial case. So this is Avila, Kahn, Lubitsch, and Shen, but there's also a version for the polynomial case. So what I want to do now is to explain how to get these bounds using this theorem. And so what I'm going to do is to give it very quick idea about what this enhanced nest is doing. So this hunt's nest is the following. So take a puzzle piece I. And let's just, I'll explain with the unicritical case in mind, because the language is a little bit easier then. So this is a puzzle piece which I'll denote like that. And there's a central component of it, of the first return domain. That's the component of the first return domain, return map that contains the critical point. And I'll denote that by J. So this is the first return map, has a central domain component, and J. And the other idea, other ingredient, is the idea of a child. So what's a child of I? Well, this is just a branch pullback of this domain. So it takes univalent pullbacks to the critical value, and then if you take one more step, it's via the critical point, so you have a branched map. So this is univalent, and this is a covering map D1 if you take a map of this type. So these are children. So these are the children, and there could be many children, and let's look at the last child. So let's call this last child B of I. Well, the main property then is the following. So let's call this map S of mu. The first property is that the critical point actually happens to land not, if you take the last child, not just anywhere, but in the central domain. So it maps here. So that's the first property. And the second property is that if you then take the pullback of J, which is, you know, you can do because F of C of this point maps them, there's a smaller domain, which we'll call A of I. Then the property is that if you take the post-critical set of F, so you look at the post-critical set in this pullback, in this, and where is it? It only contains in the smaller domain. So in other words, it's empty space. There's no post-critical set here. So there's a little bit, and that's always great if you want to apply Kerber or anything like this. So these are the main features. And if you use this in a convenient way, then you get a sequence of pullbacks, which we call our announced nest. So you need to do slight variation if you take a multi-critical map, because there are several critical points and things could go via different branches. But anyway, you get the thing, and there's some special properties. And these special properties actually imply the following. The first thing is that if you look at IN, you can map it to IN minus M. And of course, this is a map with a very high degree. So all these are pullbacks of each other. And so we could call this map FP or something, which of course depends on N and capital M. So this is. And let's look at the first return domain to IN. So this maps somewhere here. So this is the image of, let's call this A. Let's call it maybe not A, but Z. So this is the image of Z, so FP of Z. And then there are several properties there. That, well, FP of Z actually is a return or an entry domain to one of these things. So I'll draw all these annuli, all these disks, just like that. So this is the original one, IN. And here's maybe IN minus 4. And this is the first entry domain to I n minus 4. And then if you pull back these other annuli here, what you will get is actually pullbacks of all these other annuli. And what you get is around this image here, a whole nest of annuli. In fact, M of these annuli. And each of them will have a modulus which is very related to the modulus here. So what's the situation? So let's call mu n, mu I, the modulus of A I. Well, in fact, it's not quite this, but what you get then from this description is the following. Mu n, which is something like modulo modulus of I n minus this domain Z. And I want to use this inequality that I have there. It says it's bigger than this k to the power d, where d is the degree of this map. So this is the degree of is the of f to the power p divided by 2d. And then I take the minimum of some number kappa. And how many of these annuli do I have? I have something like m minus 6 of these annuli. And of course I have to, well, the sum of the total modulus is the sum of the moduli. Just using the fact that if you take a nested annuli, then the annuli of the union is the sum of the annuli. So this is the number of annuli, it's the sum of the annuli, so I take the smallest of these in this range. So you get this kind of inequality. And now it comes to the point. Well, d could be very large, but I can fix d. If I just simply take m so large, let's see, let me take I fix my k to make sure that whatever the degree here is, this is bigger than that this number is going to be bigger than 2. This product number. And this will have an effect for this kappa, but I don't care, it's just a number. I want to have that this sequence of numbers mu I remains bounded from below. And I will sort of be a little bit vague here, but that's the kind of basic idea here. So then you get bounded geometry, and actually in one more page, you get, in fact, also a complex bound, and if you do one more page, you get bounded geometry from this. All right, so I've been a little bit vague here, but so that's the idea. All right, so let me now go to the applications of ideas like this. Well, the first application is to do with that any real map, any real polynomial, can be approximated by a hyperbolic polynomial of the same degree. And this is again the result by Koslowski, Shen, and myself. And of course you have similar versions. If you take smooth maps, then they can be approximated by smooth maps in the C infinite topology. So that's the first application. The second application is something which is sort of really related to the previous talk by Gugu. And this discusses the following setting. So if you take maps not of z square plus a constant, but zd plus a constant, then this growth of moduli breaks down, and the proofs, well, at least at this moment, break down. And then the statement is the following. So then the statement is, for almost every parameter C, you have two possibilities. There exists a unique, unique invariant, unique SRB measure, unique physical measure, in the same definition as the previous talk. And moreover, so this is for each of the parameters, and then there are two possibilities. There either exists an absolute continuous invariant measure, or mu is supported on the post-critical set, supported on the iterate of the critical point, and moreover, this is uniquely ergodic. So this result doesn't actually describe what happens, for example, with for example, the case where you have infranormalizable parameters. This would just fall in this category. Fibonacci case would again fall in this category. So we don't have this kind of fine discussion that was done by Lubitsch and Avila and Moreira. But the advantage of this method is actually much more, it works in a sort of kind of softer way. And I don't have time really to discuss it in great detail. But let me just say a little bit about the ideas. So let's say that FC is non-renormalizable. And then we just define, we have decay of geometry if the following happens, if there exists an N, so that one of the two things happens, so that either gamma N minus 1 has no smallest child, so it has infinitely many, so there's not the smallest one. So this is one possibility. Or, so that's one possibility, or that the limit, if you take every time the smallest child, that this ratio goes to zero. So this is the definition of this set. And the other set that we define is if you have a summability condition of the critical value, which now is this, if this is less than zero, less than infinity for all. And then the logic is the following. And the logic is the following, that if C is not in the, has no decay of geometry, then it has what we call low combinatorial complexity, which is like the Fibonacci case, so that you have a really, and then it's uniquely ergodic. It can be more complicated than the Fibonacci, but that's the kind of setting. Or if you take, now looking at the decay of geometry case, you're saying that for almost every decay of geometry, you have this summability condition, and so you have an absolute continuous invariant measure. And in fact, you have decay of correlations and things like this. Perhaps I should just say something about this, because well, first, this is all this is Brown, Shen, and myself. And a related result, but not really using it, is the following. In fact, this is far too much for having an invariant measure. In fact, an invariant measure holds under much weaker conditions. Namely, if you just take the principal nest, so don't even consider this enhanced nest, just consider the original principal nest. So you have an interval I0, you look at the first return to it, which contains a critical point, that's I1, then the first return to that, and so on. So this sequence persists. And then the following statement is true. There exists a C. So that if F is non-renormalizable, N, this ratio actually is big enough for all N large, then you have an absolute continuous, then F has an absolutely continuous invariant measure. In fact, another condition which is of course related is that the critical value, if you look at the iterates here, then this is bigger than C for all n large, and again this implies that. So this generalizes result by Nowitzki and Martens. Yes. So this dependency is crucially dependent on the order of critical point. So colored Ekman and so on is way too much for having an absolute continuous invariant measure. So my hope is that somehow this result, which of course is much weaker than it should be and much less kind of sophisticated than the result of Avila Marrera, it could be sort of generalized to the multi-critical case more easily. That's sort of my hope. Of course, whether it works or not is another matter, because there are a lot of issues to do with multi-critical families. And okay, and then there's a final application I wanted to discuss, and that's following. If you take let's take again real polynomials, and for example cubic or maybe fourth order, and degree is not so important, and let's anchor them so that the boundary points are just mapped into themselves. And it's easy just also to have an orientation, which I denote by epsilon, whether the first branch is orientation preserving or not. And then the next theorem is the following, that if you take this space of polynomials in this setting with epsilon denoting the orientation, and you look at the topological entropy of F, and so a level set, then this set is connected. Now, of course, this is a long, an old question. I mean, it started off with a quadratic case, and in the sort of mid-80s, I guess, people were looking at quadratic family, whether the entropy was increasing. And entropy increasing, well, there it's an easy question because you have one parameter and entropy. And so what you're asking is whether the level set of entropy is connected. So the corresponding question is this one. And Milner and Presser proved this result in the case where D equals 3. We prove it now in general. And the difference is that in the case where D equals 3, when the degree is 3, that you have a two-dimensional parameter space. And it's always real parameters you're looking at. So it's actually, the plane. So you have something like a Jordan theorem. And that really means that you can really work with the things much more easily. To explain that this result is not completely clear, it's not easy, not difficult to prove, but if you take a family of cubic maps, A and B, where A stands for the height of the first critical value and B for the height of the second critical value, then certainly it's not true that this here, fixing B, that this is monotone. So it's not monotone in each of the separate variables. So this is not monotone. And what's the idea of the proof here? Well, the idea of the proof is, first we use the rigidity result that we had before. And the way this is used is that we that if you look at the set which we call the partial hyperbolicity set, so of course you have in this case the idea is to make an analogous statement to the statement that if you take if a quadratic map, the hyperbolic components, that this is connected. But of course you may have that one critical point maps to another critical point and that's in the basin of an attractor. And so what we sort of generalize is a space which is allowing for criticalations or for saying, well, one critical point is not in the basin of an attractor, but we want to fix its combinatorics. So define this thing here, and then the set is connected and has dimension equal to the number of free critical points. So it's like the McMullen-Sullivan statement. So that's the first ingredient, and that follows from this rigidity. So this is a topological cell with the dimension equal to the number of free critical points. And the second ingredient is to look at some kind of better function space. Associated to each polynomial, you can make some sort of piecewise linear model. And this already was done by Milner and Presser, but they did not really push this through, I think, far enough. So given the map F, you can associate some piecewise monotone map with plateaus. And then the idea is that this map, it's not injective. But it's sort of injective. You know exactly what the pre-images of something is. It's not surjective. Well, certainly it's not surjective if you take any map. You have to take some subspace of this thing. So you have to take some subspace of the seesaw maps, which we'll call S star. And it's not continuous, but it's almost continuous. Okay, and then the idea is, well, level sets here are connected. Well, that's very easy to show, and that was done by Milner and Presser already, if you take this full space. But then this whole picture breaks down. But if you take this special subset here, then it requires some subtle work. But anyway, it's connected, and then you pull this back sort of using kind of soft topology in essentially. So that's the last result I wanted to discuss. Thank you very much.